Hello, my friends. It's April 27th, 2026, and I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, your Red State refugee. And welcome to the Radical Russ Show, your weekly wake and bake, coming to you from Rolla J Studios in Southern Oregon. On this week's Smoke Session, let's talk about the declining quality of American assassins. The government says, let them eat Costco chickens. And Democrats agree to let Trump finish his second term. But before we get to all the serious political stuff, we've got time for three quick hits.
Run, Forrest, run!
Run, Forrest, run!
Run, Forrest, run!
Run, Forrest, run!
Come on, run, Forrest, run!
Run, Forrest, run!
Run, Forrest, run!
Run, Forrest, run!
All right, I want to take some time here at the top of the show, first of all, to thank everyone who's continuing to listen and sending me comments my way. Thank you so much. Also, I'm live streaming some of these segments now. I've decided that throughout the week, I'm going to, you know, when the mood hits me and I get the opportunity, and if I can get the chihuahuas to shut up long enough, I'm just going to sit down and record segments throughout the week and then add them to the podcast on Monday. So if you're following me on YouTube at youtube.com/RadicalRuss. From time to time, I will randomly pop up and just start live streaming. Now, I do have to set expectations. I am live streaming from my remote mountain hideaway here in beautiful Southern Oregon. And so we're on cellular internet. It's not the fastest upload speeds in the world. So the audio is pretty good. The video, it's choppy. It's not anything to really look at. So don't expect a lot there. But, you know, I'm not a video guy anyway. I'm a podcaster, old school podcaster. So this is all about audio for me. Anyway, let's get to the quick hits. And the first one here, I want to talk about the big stories in sports that have been going on this amazing world record shattering weekend in sports. I'm sure you heard about it, right? No, not the NFL draft. Yeah, NFL draft all the time. There's no world records in the NFL draft. Now, the NBA playoffs. Yeah, the NBA playoffs have been pretty exciting, but you know, no major earth-shattering records going on then. Maybe you didn't hear because it seems like it didn't show up very prominently on the ESPN homepage this weekend, this Sunday, when at the London Marathon, for the first time in world history, a human being has been recorded running a marathon in under 2 hours. Oh my God, the sub 2-minute marathon. Now, folks, I can't even imagine running a marathon. I can't even imagine running a 2-hour anything, running 2 hours. I can't even imagine running two. Actually, that's not true. I can imagine running 2 hours. We did it once in basic training when the first sergeant came back and he took us out running in the sand in Fort Dix for about 2 hours. It was like 8 miles that we ran. Yeah, I remember that. I can't even imagine doing 26.2. Now, there's a story behind this as well, because apparently the 2-hour marathon mark is like, you know, back in the day when Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, which, of course, he was not the first person to break the 4-minute mile. And there's a great Keith Olbermann podcast on that. Anyhow, the two hour marathon has been something that's been people have been going for years now. And in 2019, there was a runner from Kenya, of course, a fellow by the name of Eliud Kipchoge, from Kenya, who in 2019 ran 1 hour 59 minutes 40 seconds. And that didn't count, though, right? It was an unofficial record, because there's all sorts of rules about this, about how these road races have to, you know, officially qualify. It had to do with people that were running pace for him, right? Because apparently you can have people run pace, but he had them being swapped in every 4 kilometers or so, and that's like, you have to have a pace runner that runs with you the whole time. Technical details, right? And also had to do with fluids, like how often you could get fluids and from whom. Like, he was getting them from somebody that was bicycling by, and you can't do that. It has to be someone who's, like, come on, man. The guy ran 26.2 miles in under 2 hours, and we're gonna fault him for taking water from a bicyclist or something. But anyway, that's the rules, right? So this guy had run 159.40 back in 2019, and since then, he'd been trying to break that record again and couldn't quite get it. He was just getting, like, 2 hours and 30 seconds, right? Couldn't quite get it. So in this marathon here in London on Sunday, Yomif Kajelcha, and pardon if I'm getting the name mispronounced, Yomif Kajelcha from Ethiopia, he didn't beat that time of 159.40, but he did run 159.41. And yet, he is also not the first man to break the 2 hour marathon barrier, because he was beaten by 11 seconds by another guy named Sebastian Sawi from Kenya, who ran 159.30. That's right, folks. On Sunday morning, two men ran a sub 2 hour marathon. And it wasn't like front page ESPN news, sports. You didn't hear the sports segment on the national news break in about this. Wow. Two guys officially both broke the 2 hour marathon barrier. That should have been the sports story of the weekend.
You see, that old man don't cheat over here.
He's very dear to you, that old man.
I want that old man.
All you got for help's that old man.
Son, I washed off 6 years with that old man.
And you're much too decent to expose that old man to public ridicule.
Of course, we got some other sports stories that are going on here in the good old United States of America. Of course, the NFL draft. People were pointing out the quarterback from Indiana, the number one draft pick, Mendoza, who went to the Las Vegas Raiders, which that'll be fun. The Raiders got my guy, Ashton Jeanty, from the Boise State Broncos last year, and now they get Mendoza, the quarterback from Indiana. My lady loves Indiana Hoosiers, right? So Vegas Raiders might be turning out to be one of our second teams here. God, if they can just get Ashton Jeanty some linemen to block for him. But then the other story, of course, the NBA playoffs are going on, and I haven't been able to follow too well because, I'm poor and I don't have all the streaming services to watch what I'd like to watch, and we don't have over-the-air TV here in the mountains, but been following along to see LeBron and the Lakers, who are without, his other supporting cast members, Luka, but he's got... He's got a bunch of these scrubs, I guess, the people that haven't been really heard of, and LeBron led them to a 3-0 lead. Now, they did lose their game last night to the Rockets, but LeBron James at 41 years old, throwing down reverse dunks and alley-oop assists to his kid, I'm telling you, we got to seriously reevaluate the conversation on the greatest of all time in basketball, because I'm beginning to think it's got to be LeBron James. This is just ridiculous how he's been able to perform at the age of 41. LeBron James is the George Foreman of George Blandas. That's right. He's the George Foreman of George Blandas, man. These guys are just going on forever. And as an old guy myself, it does my heart good. What doesn't do my heart good is my beloved Portland Trailblazers, who are now down 3-1 in their series against the Spurs. Victor Wembanyama is back from his concussion protocol. This guy, 7'4" with an 8-foot wingspan, runs the floor like a point guard. It's ridiculous the skills the big men in the NBA have these days. Unbelievable. And I'm just glad the Spurs aren't going to sweep the Blazers. Of course, the best thing would be for the Blazers to pull this out and go on a three-game winning streak and win the series. I don't foresee that happening, but let's hope maybe they get another win. Go Blazers! And, wow, this last game, this loss they had, whew. Apparently, the Spurs became the first team in NBA playoff history to be down 15 at the half. Blazers had a 15-point lead at the half. And then lose by 15 or more. Oh my God, a 30-point swing. This is just terrible. So, not looking good for my beloved Portland Trailblazers. Good luck up there in Portland.
But there are two ways of calculating it.
Well, that's the math we don't have yet, gentlemen.
You do the math.
Well, if it drops from 600 to 100, that's a 600% savings.
Look, Ed, there's only one problem with all this math.
It was my understanding that there would be no math.
One last quick hit here, and, you know, I tried to avoid playing the Mango Mussolini's voice on the podcast as much as possible, but this particular clip I've got to play because, well, I just got to play this because it's the most Emperor Has No Clothes thing. He's in the Oval Office, the gold-vomited Oval Office, sitting behind the Resolute desk. He's got his cabinet members behind him. There's J.D. Vance and I think Lutnick's there, RFK Jr., Dr. Oz, you know, some others. I can't make them all out, but he's there in front of the camera, sitting behind the desk, and he goes off on that whole prescription drug price drop thing that he does. Listen it.
I was reminded when the president was speaking of a conversation that I had yesterday with one of the Democratic senators who was questioning me during a hearing, and she was ridiculing President Trump for his math, and she was saying it's mathematically impossible to have a drug drop by 600% cost, which he had claimed. And I said, well, if the drug was $100 and it raised the price to $600, that would be a 600% rise. If it drops from 600 to 100, that's a 600% savings. And the president used that mathematical device to illustrate the magnitude of the theft that has been happening against our country and our people, as he said.
I wish I could go back in time to the times when I'd get something wrong on a math test in school and say, oh, no, sorry, teacher, that was my use of a mathematical device. First of all, RFK, you didn't even get the math right in the first place with the price rise. If something is $100 and it rises to $600, it rose by $500. That's a 500% rise, not a 600% rise.
It is amazing. And you're right. I took a lot of heat. I'd say 500, 600. 700. But we also say sometimes 50%, 60%, different kind of calculation. 70, 80, and 90%. And people understand that better. But there are two ways of calculating it. But either way, it doesn't make any difference whether it's...
Yes, it does make a freaking difference. Oh my God. That you can calculate something two ways. I was a precocious little kid. I finished my entire second grade math book in like a week. I was teaching myself exponents and how to do exponential math by the time I was hitting fifth grade. If President Ford had gotten on the television and said something like this, at 7 years old, I would have turned to my dad and asked, how come the president doesn't understand simple math?
It was my understanding that there would be no math.
Our top story tonight.
Our top story tonight.
Our top story tonight.
Our top story tonight.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky.
The Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no. And they'll push, and I'll say no. And they'll push again, and I'll say to them, read my lips.
He also wrote this: I'm no longer willing to permit a pedophile, rapist, and traitor to coat my hands with his crimes. What's your reaction
to that?
Well,
I was waiting for you to read that because I knew you would, because you're horrible people. Horrible people. Yeah, he did write that. I'm not a rapist. I didn't rape anybody.
Do you think he was referring to you?
Excuse me. I'm not a pedophile.
All right, well, I know on last week's podcast I made a pledge to try to make it a Trump-free podcast, but I can't go on without talking about this so-called assassination attempt at the White House Correspondents' Dinner And I'm recording this on Sunday so I could do this with all of my thoughts still fresh in my head and my feed from Blue Sky last night, as I pretty much posted live throughout the event as it was breaking down. So I just wanted to cover that and some of the things that I was thinking. First of all, I thought it was kind of interesting that this White House Correspondents' Dinner, they were going to be giving out an award for the reporting on the Epstein birthday card that Donald Trump wrote with the wonderful secrets and the enigmas never age and his signature where the pubic hair should be. So an award was going to be given out for that, and an award was going to be given out for that photograph in the Oval Office where Trump is standing there clueless while someone is having a medical emergency off to his left. So two awards that would have been very embarrassing to him. I just thought that it was interesting that those two were kind of postponed because of the interruption by the gunfire. Coincidence, I'm sure. I'm sure it's just coincidence. And I'm sure Caroline Leavitt, speaking to Fox News before the event, just used an unfortunate turn of phrase.
Ready to rumble, is he not?
He is ready to rumble. Uh-huh. I will tell you, this speech tonight will be classic Donald J. Trump. It'll be funny. It'll be entertaining. There will be some shots fired tonight in the room. So everyone should tune in. It's going to be really great. I'm looking forward to hearing it.
I love it all. And what you wrote most of it.
So everyone should tune in.
Let's say that again. Really,
there will be some shots fired tonight in the room.
There will be some shots fired tonight in the room. Just a bad turn of phrase. Maybe not the thing you want to say. And maybe they were hyping it up. Maybe she was just hyping it up because Trump had this big speech plan where he had all these zingers ready to go. Those would be the shots fired, the metaphorical shots fired. Now, understand, if somebody on MS Now or CNN, one of the liberal commentators, had said something to that effect and then shots were literally fired, especially as we're finding out the shooter is from California and seems to have leanings to the left, I don't think they'd have taken that not so seriously, to talking about shots fired. But let's go on here. I'm just kind of going through my feed as it happened. Oh, yes. And then after it happened, everybody immediately pivots to the ballroom. This is why we've got to have a ballroom. But as the news has come out about this shooting, this guy, Cole, his name is, Cole Allen, I think, came running down from the upstairs, so he wasn't even on the same floor, had to get down some stairs to the first security area, and then there were like magnetometers beyond that and two more security places to get to before he'd even get into the ballroom. He rushes as fast as he can, and he's stopped. So why do you need the ballroom? Seems like the security was just fine. He got nowhere near any of the principals. And there's also a note coming out about the coordination from all the right-wing influencers that shortly after the event, suddenly, all of them in concert coordinated their calls for the ballroom. Oh, this is why we have to have a ballroom. This is why it's not secure enough. We got to have the ballroom. Interesting how he's so concerned about his bulletproof, blast-proof bunker. As dictators tend to get toward the end of their careers, they want to make sure they have a nice secure bunker. And many people have been pointing out, Covey online pointed out, all these politicians running for their lives during a shooting finally got to understand how kids in schools feel. And that's something I pointed out too, is that, you know, these reporters that are trying to gender some sympathy for having gone through this are going to find, and I think through the Sunday shows today, they found that it's all fallen flat. Because it's not whether or not we think this was faked. And first of all, there's a ton of people out there that think this was faked and believe that the Butler assassination was faked as well. And that's the thing, is it really doesn't matter whether it was faked. I don't think it was. I never ascribe to conspiracy and malice, that which can be explained by incompetence and muddling through. That's one of Tufte's laws, Professor Tufte. I think they're incompetent and they're muddling through. The thing that kills the idea of any sort of conspiracy theory from the Trump administration, the Trump regime, in my mind, is the fact they can't secure indictments from grand juries. They can't run a military operation without inviting a reporter to their signal chat, right? This is the gang that can't shoot state, the Keystone Cops. They don't have the wherewithal to be able to manage a conspiracy, any sort of grand conspiracy. They don't have the ability. They're not competent enough to run a grand conspiracy. A lot of this, I think, is coincidence, like Caroline Leavitt saying the shots will be fired. I think that's just incompetence. That's like poor PR to use, you know, gun imagery especially when you're representing the administration in a country where, what, we've had 151 mass shootings as of today. It's day 116 of 2026. So, yeah, try to stay away from the gun imagery there. But I can see why people think this would be faked, because if anyone was going to fake it, it would be someone as unscrupulous as Trump, as someone with nothing to lose, someone as criminal as Trump. Certainly, I just don't think they have the mental capacity and operational security to be able to pull off a grand conspiracy like that. But talk about fortuitous. I mean, how can you get your 33% approval rating boosted and get the base back on your side and give Cash Patel a chance to rehab his reputation by showing up and being there at some big shooting event and stop the presentation of the embarrassing Epstein type awards and, you know, just don't kill a firefighter this time, right? Let's stop him in the lobby. Also, think about this. By stopping him in the lobby, legally, was it even an assassination attempt? He was, if you're a defense lawyer, you're arguing this guy just ran in with a gun. I mean, how do we know it wasn't just a mass shooting? Right? Well, we got his manifesto. That's how we know. Still, that's his intent. That as far as the firearms charge, as far as attempted assassination, we'll have to see. Again, this is the gang that can't shoot straight. Can Jeanine Box of Wine Pirro actually get an indictment for this? We'll see. So many of the people here, and the photos. I love this photo that came up with you the moment it happened, where Todd Blanche and Melania Trump, and I think it's Selena Wang, the White House correspondence president there, sitting at the dais, where the three of them are reacting in shock, and Trump is just oblivious. And people pointing out that this is how you know it's faked. But look at Trump's reaction. He knows he's in on it. He knows it's all faked. Or he's an oblivious, near 80-year-old man with dementia who's usually falling asleep. Maybe that could be an explanation as well. But like I pointed out, you get out of being booed by the reporters, you get out of the walkout, if they were going to stage a walkout, you forestall those two awards, you create the need for the bunker ballroom, you boost sagging poll numbers, you get press sympathy, you distract from Epstein, from Iran, from the economy. But that could also be explained by them just being craven opportunists. Like the minute something like this happens, that's just their gut reaction is to go into overdrive and go for the ballroom and dial up the fascism to 11. Like maybe it's not a prior motivation that led to the conspiracy for the shooting, but that the shooting happened and then they jumped on that opportunity. I think that's a little easier to understand. There is also this clip that made a lot of people, that raised a lot of eyebrows, where Fox News is interviewing one of the Fox reporters. I think the woman's named Aisha. And this reporter says she was sitting next to Caroline Leavitt's husband. Remember, Caroline Leavitt said there'll be shots fired. And this is how she reports the husband spoke to her just moments before the gunfire went out.
I was sitting next to Caroline Leavitt, the press secretary's husband. He was one of our guests. He was seated right next to me. And, right as the dinner was starting, the national anthem happened. And then he kind of leaned over and said, you know, I watched you on TV. You did a great job. You need to be very safe. And he was just very serious when he said that to me. And he kind of looked around the room and he said, you know, there are some...
Sounds like we lost Aisha's phone there.
Yeah, just happened to lose her phone as she was talking about how she was being warned about being extra safe by the husband of the press secretary. So is this one coincidence? And she just happens to get cut off? Yeah, I know it's sketchy. But, you know, calls get cut off, cell phones get cut off all the time. It could have a legit explanation. The other part of this that was hilarious to me, I was watching all this reporting on ABC News Live on the streaming app. And, of course, all the reporters that are calling in and doing their live shots are still in their tuxedos from the black tie event, right? White Horse Correspondents' Dinner. And so I noted online, Pierre Thomas, the reporter from ABC News, he gets on and I noted his bow tie game. Because he has this really wide bow tie, right? Like it, well, like the top is like normal, but the bottom like droops way low, which kind of reminds me of Nikki Glaser's latest special. Anyway, so this is a big, huge bow tie. And I noted, you know, great bow tie game. Because this is one of them, it's not a clip on, right? This is one of them, you got to actually tie the bow tie. And so someone I follow, or someone that follows me, a guy named Ollie2009 on Blue Sky, pointed out that the Department of Homeland Security Secretary, Mark Wayne Mullen, is wearing a regular suit and a black tie because he read the invitation which said black tie, and he didn't know it meant tux and bow tie. And the pictures, there he is with his wife, who looks wonderful, wearing a nice, elegant black dress. Mark Wayne looks like he's going to a funeral. He's got a literal black suit, like a suit, not a tux, like a blazer, single-breasted suit, black suit, white shirt, long black tie. He's ready for a funeral. Oh, that at least gave me a laugh during last night. And another picture that's going out that has people questioning all this is at the presser. First of all, right after the event happened, too, right after the shooting event happened, Trump, the first thing he's saying is, you know, well, the show must go on. Let's have the dinner. Let's keep going. Until law enforcement said, well, no, you know, like, we don't know if this is one guy, if there's still an active threat. What? You know, get real. But Trump wanted the show to go on because he had all these zingers prepared. He was going to really sock it to the press. So they held a press conference there, and then all the reporters show up. You know, they're still in their tuxes, and the rest of the administration's in their tuxes. And it led to a bunch of questions, like, first of all, why are they all grinning and smirking? Here's a picture with Rubio, Keg Seth, Levitt, Melania, J.D. Vance, and Attorney General Todd Blanche, and Trump. They're all in their tuxes. Well, the ladies are in their dresses. All in their formal wear. And they all have a smirk on their face. Now, people are pointing to this, saying, see, they think we're stupid. They're getting away with it. They're smirking because they're getting away with it. Maybe. Maybe. Or maybe they're just sadists who delight in the press being terrorized. That the press was all freaked out. And there the press is, all in the room, all scared and huddled and looking to dear leader. And maybe they're just smirking because they feel like Trump is winning the media cycle. I mean, there are non-conspiratorial reasons these things could be happening. I think there's like this pattern recognition, you know, confirmation bias that we're all having on the left. Like, because Trump is so mendacious, he is such a fraud, he is such a cheat, that if anyone was going to cheat, he's the guy who would. So I can see why people jump to these conclusions. But, you know, Carl Sagan said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Until I see that extraordinary evidence, I can't believe that this is going to be some sort of conspiracy that's unearthed. Another thing that caught my attention, Trump, when he was speaking up there, said, only the most consequential presidents get assassination threats. They always shoot at the ones who are getting the most done, who are the most consequential, like Abraham Lincoln, like John Kennedy, right? Like only the consequential presidents get assassination attempts. This was great. This was news to the Garfield, McKinley, and Ford presidential museums, right? Like, yeah, everybody remembers President Ford. You know, President Ford, up until this one here, had the record for most assassination attempts, like two. It was two times they tried to get Ford. And now what? It's two on Trump or three on Trump because we count that golf course one too, right? You ever notice that these assassination attempts are getting farther and farther away too? The Butler guy, you know, allegedly nicked him in the ear, although that ear has miraculously healed. And then the next one was the Palm Beach golf course where he was like one hole away when they caught up with the guy. And now it's this guy from California who took a train to D.C. with a whole bunch of weapons and parked up in the hotel and was a whole floor away. They're just getting farther and farther away. And, oh, the other thing that people point out, Dan Scavino, shortly after the ballroom is in chaos, trying to lead a USA chant. USA, USA, and the people in the room pretty much shut it down, like, shut the fuck up. Is that evidence that it was a setup? Or is it just evidence that Dan Scavino and the rest of these people are craven opportunists that are always trying to set the stage, always trying to make it a political rah-rah USA rally? I think that makes a little more sense. And then as the Sunday shows came on, well, that was my posting from last night. And as the Sunday shows came on, they had people on to discuss this. Dana Bash on CNN had Representative Jamie Raskin on. And she had this question for him.
Yeah. And you have, and as many of your fellow Democrats, have used some heated rhetoric against the president. And do you think twice about that when something like this happens?
And I'm just going to cut off Jamie Raskin, who gives a fine response, but he has to give just the cool, level-headed response when really this should be the Batman slapping Robin meme. This woman's literally named Bash. And we're talking about a politics in which Donald Trump is saying, open the fucking strait, you crazy bastards. I'm going to destroy and rain hell down on and destroy your civilization. The press is the enemy of the people. The cops ought not be too nice to people. Be a little rough with them. I'd like to punch that guy in the mouth. And you have the gall to say Democrats have a problem with heated rhetoric. We have a problem with heated rhetoric by describing him accurately. I mean, my goodness. Just insane. And the other thing to think about, this one got me thinking. I love the little icon. So Trump never goes to the White House Correspondents Association dinner during his whole first term or last year. Decides this year he's going to go. And not only does he go, but the vice president, the secretary of state, the secretary of defense, basically the line of succession, the first two or three, the Speaker of the House was there too. So like the first four, five, six, seven levels of the line of succession in the United States, all in one place at one time, while we're in the middle of a war with Iran that was begun with a decapitation strike that took out all their leadership chain. If anything, it's just showing once again, these guys are so incompetent, so unable to understand basic operational security that you can't ascribe to them the ability to pull off these massive grand conspiracies that some people are thinking of. Here's the Dan Scavino USA USA chant that failed.
God bless America! USA! USA! USA!
Yeah, just they're just lame. I don't think that shows that they were planning it. I just think it shows they're lame. Oh, and also, isn't the National Guard still patrolling the streets of Washington, D.C.? Didn't we eliminate all crime in Washington, D.C. because Trump activated the National Guard, who's still patrolling around? So what good were they? Didn't seem to stop this guy. Telling you, this is just crazy. And then, of course, adding to the cacophony of MAGA bleating for the ballroom, we get Senator John Fetterman, the Republican from Pennsylvania. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I'm getting word once again that, yes, Fetterman is still technically a Democrat. Fetterman writes, "We were there front and center. That venue wasn't built to accommodate an event with the line of succession for the U.S. government. After witnessing last night, drop the TDS and build the White House ballroom for events exactly like these." First of all, TDS, he's not talking about The Daily Show. He's talking about Trump derangement syndrome. So here you have a United States senator from the Democratic Party who uses the talking points and framing of the Republican Party to describe his own party members. And second of all, the White House Correspondents Association dinner isn't supposed to be an event that's hosting the line of succession for the U.S. government. It never has. But it was this time for some reason. Can't wait till we get rid of Fetterman. At this point, like, what's the point of keeping him as a Democrat? What is the point? The judges and whatever else, I suppose. We need to win this next election with a Fetterman-proof majority. And then on the other side, you know what? I'll save Hakeem Jeffries for another time. Folks are pointing out also that this event took place. Jennifer Jacobs reports, "I don't think people hearing about this, or even those of us in the room, realized how far from the president, vice president, and other guests this incident was. It was on another floor, up some stairs and several sets of security away." Several sets of security away. Another photo on my feed. Again, I'm live streaming this on my Radical Rush YouTube page as well. And I'll be doing that for some of these segments on the podcast from now on. So if you actually want to see the things I'm talking about on the podcast, you can check out these segments. Look for them on the youtube.com/Radical Russ. Another photo from behind the curtains, Pete Hegseth walking out after the press conference with a shit-eating grin on his face. But again, I don't think that means they think they got away with it. I think that means that they're winning the media battle. I think that means that they feel like this random chaotic event happened and only Donald Trump, the master of reality TV, can turn it around and make it a win that we owned the liberals and we beat the press. That's what I think they're grinning about. Now, the shooter, they've now found his manifesto. And I've read this manifesto, and Trump and his regime are trying to say this is an anti-Christian manifesto, that he had hatred for Christians. They are, and this is another data point to me that shows it's not pre-planned. It's them being craven opportunists trying to take advantage of it because they want to boost Trump. After all this Pope fighting and Jesus pictures, they want to get the evangelicals back on the side. So, see, I'm Trump, and see, they hate the Christians, and they are trying to kill me, right? I think that's the part that Trump's doing here. But when you read this guy's manifesto, it's not that he's anti-Christian. He claims to be doing this as a Christian. He actually makes an apology to the other members of his church, okay? And a lot of his explanation of how he's going to go about and do the act references what he would see as sins as a Christian, right? So he sees this himself behaving as a Christian to go after people who are anti-Christian, that being the administration, the regime. He made this point in objection one. As a Christian, you should turn the other cheek. Objection being like what he thinks people in his church and people who know him, how they would object to the act he's about to perpetrate. And he says, rebuttal, Turning the other cheek is for when you yourself are oppressed. I'm not the person raped in a detention camp. I'm not the fisherman executed without a trial. I'm not a school kid blown up, or a child starved, or a teenage girl abused by the many criminals in this administration. Turning the other cheek when someone else is oppressed is not Christian behavior. It is complicity in the oppressor's crimes. So Trump did this interview with Nora O'Donnell, and she brought up this whole manifesto, and Trump tries to paint it as being anti-Christian. I just wish somebody would do a follow-up on this. When he says the manifesto is anti-Christian, what part of it was anti-Christian? What sentence, what paragraph, what statement in it was anti-Christian? Because they won't be able to answer that. And then when they're not able to answer that, bring up this objection number one, where he says, I'm not the person raped in a detention camp. I'm not the fisherman executed without a trial. I'm not the school kid blown up or child starved or teenage girl abused. And point out that that is anti-Christian behavior and what he was against. Now, I should make the caveat that everyone has to make these things. I am not in favor of this guy and what he did or what he was trying to do. I'm not in favor of taking violent action like this. One, just for the moral aspect, it's wrong. But two, from the tactical aspect, it provides sympathy to their side. It gives credence to their idea that there's a they out there of radical leftists that are ready to kill Christians. It helps the other side. Dr. King taught us about nonviolent resistance, taught us about how to win these kind of battles. And this is not the way. Bringing violence is not the way. But the points he makes, the reasoning behind why he turned to violence, those can't be denied. Those should be addressed. And if we had a decent set of journalists out there, maybe they would. But don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. So let me get to the Nora O'Donnell clip, because this is, to my mind, the most telling thing. Because in this manifesto and in people trying to research this guy and going back through his social media posts and the things that he boosted and quote posted and liked and so forth and shared and all that, by going through all this, it forces these milquetoast journalists, these stenographers, the access of evil, it forces them to have to actually say things to Trump's face that they themselves won't say, despite the facts and the record being on their side to say them. They can't poke their head out the window to tell you whether it's raining, but if someone else comes in to say it's raining, they can report that that guy said it's raining. So here goes Nora O'Donnell, finally bringing up the questions that nobody has bothered to put to Trump's face before.
The so-called manifesto is a stunning thing to read, Mr. President. He appears to reference a motive in it. He writes this, quote, administration officials, they are targets. And he also wrote this, I am no longer willing to permit a pedophile, rapist, and traitor to coat my hands with his crimes. What's your reaction
to
that?
Well, I was waiting for you to read that because I knew you would, because you're horrible people. Horrible.
So obviously, whenever Trump is caught, whenever someone's got him in a got his soft spot, whenever they found the chink in his armor, that's the first place he goes, especially when it's a woman reporter. You're disgusting. You're viable. You're vile. You're a horrible person. You're awful. You're low IQ. That's a tell, because she's got him.
Horrible people. Yeah, he did write that. I'm not a rapist. I didn't rape anybody.
Do you think he was referring
excuse me,
to you?
Excuse me.
That's so perfect. First of all, let me give you an award. Award for that shocked look on Nora O'Donnell's face. Because she laid the trap, didn't she? She laid the trap. He wrote that he could no longer have a rapist, a pedophile, and a traitor coat his hands with his crimes. Trump says, I'm not a rapist, I'm not a pedophile. Oh, you think he was talking about you? Quell surprise. Oh, real you? Oh, my goodness. Go on, Donnie. Keep digging.
I'm not a pedophile. You read that crap from some sick person. I got associated with all stuff that has nothing to do with me. I was totally exonerated. Your friends on the other side of the plate are the ones that were involved with, let's say, Epstein or other things. But I said to myself, you know, I'll do this interview and they'll probably, I read the manifesto, you know, he's a sick person, but you should be ashamed of yourself reading that because I'm not any of those things.
Mr. President,
and I
these
was
are
never,
the
excuse
gunman's
me,
words.
Excuse me. You shouldn't be reading that on 60 Minutes. You're a disgrace, but go ahead, let's finish the interview.
The other thing that he
wrote. Yeah, huh. Yeah, such a tell. Also notice that he didn't deny the traitor part. I'm not a rapist. I'm not a pedophile. Traitor, maybe, but not a rapist and a pedophile. Goodness, no. Yeah. So finally, all of this is going to get uncovered. The journalists are going to have to report it as it's being written by, well, the shooter said, you know, that you're blowing up boats without, you're blowing up fishermen without due cause, and that you're killing young girls in schools, and that people, teenagers were abused. I love that all of that's going to come out now, because now they're forced to report someone else having said that. And like I said at the top of this, folks, it's not that it's fake. It's that we don't care whether it's true. We don't care anymore. Trump has set the table of a world of political violence where, like, we are reacting with the same, with less vitriol and the same disdain as they did for Melissa Hortman in Minnesota when she was gunned down and her husband and their dog. They made jokes about it. When Paul Pelosi was beaten with a hammer, Trump himself was making jokes about it. So you set the table, man. You're the one who made it so that, hey, we can just joke about this. Political violence? Oh, it's a Tuesday. Whatever. And these press people to think that we're going to have any sympathy for them being scared that a shooter was taken down on another floor. When they had armed Secret Service and security all around them to protect them. Thinking about the average first or second grader in that same situation, barricading a room with their desks with only their teacher to protect them. Yeah, it's not that it's fake. It's that we don't care whether it's true.
Got any fried chicken?
Best damn chicken in the state.
I'm sorry, you want some chicken?
Bring me 4 fried chickens and a Coke.
Mignon, you want some chicken?
4 fried chickens and a Coke.
You want some chicken?
You want some chicken?
You two are gonna just walk right out that door without your dry white toast, without your 4 fried chickens.
Well, I just had to get on the microphone to talk about this story I saw just now popping up in my Blue Sky feed. It's from Michael Bennett, the Democratic senator from Colorado. And the Post says, Congress should be making it easier for families to put food on the table. That's why I joined my colleagues to introduce this bill to let SNAP participants buy hot rotisserie chicken. There's no good reason a family can buy a cold one, but not a hot one. And this is a hot rotisserie chicken act for SNAP beneficiaries. That's a Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps, as it was colloquially known when I was growing up, when I was on it. I am a SNAP recipient currently and in the past, even going back to days when it was actual stamps, actual paper tickets that you had to rip out of a little booklet. I've had my government cheese. I've grown up on the stuff, so I have some opinions, and so I wanted to get to the details about this and give you my take on this act, which, great. First of all, let me just come right out and say, yes, of course, this is a good thing. There's a Good Morning America piece on this that details it. And I wanted to just note this because there was a, you know, there's some bipartisan support on this. You got Democratic Senator Michael Bennet, and then Republican Senator from Pennsylvania, John Fetterman, said, quote, hold on, I'm sorry, I'm getting some deep. Oh, John Fetterman's a Democrat. Really? All right. So Democratic Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman said, quote, America's best and delicious affordability play is Costco's $4.99 rotisserie chicken. It's one of my family's favorites, and I'm proud to join this bill with Senator Jim Justice for all to try. SNAP funds would be well spent to feed our nation's families who need it. And so he's joining with Republicans. There are some Republicans on board with this. Senator Jim Justice and Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, and Democratic Senator Michael Bennet, as we mentioned. So two Democrats, two Republicans. Justice said it would make it easier for families to put meals on the table, adding, quote, allowing folks on SNAP to buy hot rotisserie chickens is just truly common sense. It's as basic as you can get to help busy parents or grandparents put something as simple as this on the table to feed their families. We have to give people the option to put a healthy, protein-dense choice on the table that actually tastes good and doesn't take an hour and a half to cook. Capito said that the proposal reflects the realities faced by many SNAP recipients, calling it, quote, a simple, practical step to make the program work better for the people it serves. For seniors, working families, and those without reliable access to cooking equipment, this is about convenience and dignity. Bennet said the legislation would remove an unnecessary barrier for families and help them get a quick, nutritious meal when they need it. And this highlights something about the way the law currently is. It's always bothered me. When you go in the Costco, and it's not just Costco, although Lord knows Costco is going to benefit from this. You go into a Safeway or a Fred Meyer Kroger or whatever, and they'll have those rotisserie chickens for sale. And if you go in early in the morning like I do, before they put the hot chickens up, they got the cold chickens from the day before that didn't sell. They got those sitting there for sale. And those are SNAP eligible. You can buy those. You can buy the cold ones, but you can't buy the hot ones, right? So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Why should I be able to buy the same damn thing just because it's sat for long enough? All right, poor person, it's sat for long enough. Now you can have it. So yes, this bill makes sense. And I got to say, it was also refreshing to read a story about John Fetterman Fetterman. But this is one of these things where I listened to what Justice and Capito were saying about, you know, putting hot, nutritious meals on the table that taste good, don't take an hour and a half to cook, about convenience and dignity for the families. And I'm thinking, yes, and eating Costco chicken all the time is going to get old. So yes, and I can make the case for a whole lot of hot prepared foods that match the case that they're being made for the Costco chickens. So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Why wouldn't we expand this to include more people? So in addition to that, this just kind of opens up something that I've always thought about. And that is, why shouldn't we have SNAP kitchens? You know, like soup kitchens, right? But SNAP kitchens. Why not license people to open up kitchens to serve people on SNAP? Or hell, don't limit to that. Just give these licenses to restaurants, anybody from restaurants to food trucks, to be able to sell SNAP-eligible meals. Now, you could have requirements on that, I suppose, right? You could have it like, you know, it has to be so much nutrition in it, you know, and has to be so little a cost to make it, or you can't have a whole lot all at once. You can't bring in, you know, try to eat a whole, you know, all you can eat for your SNAP, whatever. I don't know how you'd set it up. I don't know what the rules have to be. Certainly, we're not going to, like, have, you know, Dairy Queen giving away blizzards, you know, on SNAP, or Ruth's Chris Steakhouse, you know, having, you know, $80 steaks on SNAP. No, but we got to figure something out, right? Make some sort of limit so at least everybody gets to eat. Everybody gets to eat. And for that matter, give everyone SNAP. Give everyone SNAP. Seriously, What are we even doing society for? What's this society for if not to feed everyone? The most basic thing. Give everyone a SNAP card. And on this SNAP card, each week, it loads up with the amount that you would get, that you would need to have one dine out meal and two eat at home meals a day. And then the card resets each week, so you can't build up funds on it, right? Let's say you get, I don't know, $100 a week, $200 a week. I don't know what the number would be. But you get that much a week. You either spend it all or you don't, but at the start of the next week, it's back to that level. And if you splurged a little too much through the week and the SNAP card was out toward the weekend, now you're having to spend cash to get food, whatever. But if you ate well and didn't spend it all, well, then there's that much savings to the people. You didn't eat all your SNAP funds and great. But whatever, everybody eats. My girlfriend has this health benefits card where you get X amount of dollars to be spent, and it can be spent on certain things like Band-Aids and rubbing alcohol and, you know, gauze, but also can be spent on certain food items. And it doesn't allow you to buy candy or sodas or anything like that, but you can get, you know, cream of mushroom soup or whatever. And it works like that. It's not every week, but it works every month. You spend up to that amount of money every month. And so we're really diligent about that. We use that card to make sure that we're stocked up on staples and all the kind of things that we need. Works wonderfully. And if we don't spend it, well, it just resets. You lost out on spending that much money that month. And not everybody's going to use this. Maybe you're rich. Doesn't matter. You still get a card. You still get a SNAP card, even if you're rich. Now, maybe you don't use it because, like, yo, it's beneath you. And you'd never eat at a SNAP kitchen or be caught dead using a SNAP card. Fine. That money doesn't get spent. Great. Fantastic. Thank you for contributing to the economy. Thank you to contributing so that other people can continue to eat. It also means we didn't spend any money on means testing and everybody eats. Everybody eats. Why is this a hard idea? How will we pay for it? Oh my God, how will we pay it? Shut the fuck up. We're about $2 billion a day in Iran, something like that, on these missiles, asking for a $1.5 trillion defense budget. And we want to know, how are we going to pay for people to eat bean and rice burritos or you know, simple chicken dinners or whatever? Come on. I don't ever want to hear anybody give the how are we going to pay for it excuse ever again. It's no longer how can we pay for it. It's political will. Can you imagine, though, the surge in the restaurant industry if people had a weekly government allowance for 7 basic low-cost meals a week? The jobs that would be created in the farms and in restaurants and food trucks. And that can't be AI out. They can't be roboted out. They have to be people in those jobs. Jobs created, business created, and everybody eats. Because I know Costco's just loving this idea, smacking their lips at all that sweet SNAP money that'll be flooding into their stores from people who are also going to have to save up that $65 cash to get their annual Costco membership you need to be able to buy a dozen or so chickens at the top of the month when you get your SNAP funds. Fine, great. Costco profits, great. But everybody eats. Let's also let everyone profit from the guy for the food truck to the restaurant. And there's still going to be people out there that want to buy steak and lobster with Dom Perignon that SNAP won't cover. And there'll still be restaurants that'll serve them that buy with cash or whatever. There'll still be food trucks that are selling unhealthy food that SNAP won't cover. You know, ice cream and funnel cakes at the fair or whatever. But that's so what? At least everyone eats. Jobs are created. I know. I'm a dreamer. I'm a dreamer with radical ideas for this allegedly Christian nation. Like everybody eats. Look, I shop at Costco nearly every day for work. And it's one of my 3 work lunches. the Costco $2 slice of pepperoni pizza, or the Costco $1.50 hot dog and a soda, or Taco Bell's $1.89 bean and rice burrito. But I can't get any of those with Snap. Only the $5 chicken? Not the easiest thing to eat in the car. So yay, yay, Snap-eligible rotisserie chicken. It's a good thing. I'm all for it. Neat first step. But our goal should be that everybody eats. And why shouldn't that be the federal subsidization of subsistence-level nutrition through existing private operators that boosts farm and restaurant profits and boosts entry-level employment? Everybody wins, and everybody eats.
Brave Sir Robin, you go.
Well, I mean, you really don't have to, sir.
Oh, I surrender peacefully.
Do I wish to surrender?
We surrender.
I advise you to seek terms for surrender.
To frighten the rebels into an immediate surrender.
We surrender.
Brave Sir Robin, run away.
No!
All right, folks, I know a lot of you out there are looking forward to the midterm elections so that we can finally put Democrats in control of the United States Congress and put an end to the lawless abuses of the Trump regime, from executing citizens in broad daylight, the streets of Minneapolis, to bombing fishermen in boats in the Caribbean without any sort of due process, stealing Central American leaders in the middle of the night, decapitating the entire leadership structure of the Iranian regime to install a more hardline, revenge-seeking son in his place, to close down the Strait of Hormuz, to have absolutely no exit strategy, a regime that's been threatening our NATO allies, pushing Europe away from us, enriching Putin in every way they can. I know you're so looking forward to the midterm, so finally, Democrats will be in power and can do something about it. And then, yes, there's Hakeem Jeffries, who would be the Speaker of the House, allegedly, should the Democrats take control. And he was interviewed on Sunday on Fox News Sunday, of all places, you know, visiting the Fox News channel, being so fair and balanced toward the Democrats as they are. And when asked if impeachment was a top priority, Hakeem Jeffries said, of course not. Of course not. Of course not. Why would we want to go and impeach Donald Trump? So there you have it, folks. I know you're so looking forward to the midterms. So just understand, Hakeem Jeffries is promising you that if you elect the Democrats and put them into power, Donald Trump gets to serve out the rest of his term. That's the guarantee. It's a guarantee, folks. When you vote for Democrats this November, understand that comes with the guarantee that they will do nothing to try to remove Donald Trump from office. They're not even going to try. Now, Jeffries says, quote, "I've made clear from the very beginning that our top priority is going to be to drive down the high cost of living." Oh, yes, affordability. Who had affordability on their bingo card? Yes, affordability. Yeah, we don't like the $5 gas. Yes, for sure. We don't like the high cost of rent and food and all that. Yes, those things are bad. I agree. But doesn't this sound a whole lot like President Obama, 2008? Yep, we just need to recover from the economic crash. We just need to get things affordable again. Don't hold anyone accountable. Don't rock the boat in any way. Democrats are leading us down this same path. Jeffries continued, quote, "We believe in this country, you work hard, you play by the rules." You play by the rules. You play by the rules. You and me play by the rules. Donald Trump, he gets to do whatever the fuck he wants. And we're not going to do a goddamn thing about it. We're going to let him serve out the rest of the term. We're going to give him this guarantee right here before the midterms. We're going to tell him, go ahead, Donald. All the crimes you're committing, the billions that you're siphoning off the United States Treasury, literally suing the IRS and leading his Justice Department to come up with a settlement of just how much money he can back up the dump truck and just funnel right out of the Treasury with no fight whatsoever. Amazing that this guy, this fraud, This racist slumlord from Queens, who always wished to be a billionaire and always was a fake fraud credit billionaire, is going to actually get to be a real billionaire now. From all the grift, from all the crypto, from all the bribes, and from the outright theft from the United States Treasury. But nah, Hakeem's not too worried about that. You play by the rules. You work hard. Donald Trump, he just gets to steal money from the Treasury that you worked hard for and paid taxes on. Hakeem continues, you should be able to live an affordable life, a comfortable life. In fact, to live the good life, and that means a good paying job and good housing, good health care, good education for your children, and when it's all said and done, a good retirement. Oh, yeah. Okay, so I suppose, Hakeem, you're going to get into power and you're going to write all these bills that give us this good, comfortable, affordable life. And hopefully, maybe we've got the Senate, too. And you know, let's just be optimistic. Let's say we have the Senate, too, and we actually have a Fetterman-proof majority. And we get it past the Senate, and then it goes to Donald Trump's desk to sign. You know, the guy that you said is going to be able to serve out the rest of his term for the next 2 years while you're in power. You're not going to do anything to challenge him to get him out of power. You're just going to let him sit there and veto and veto and veto every bill that you send to him. Gregory Meeks, who's a fellow Republican from New York, or sorry, fellow Democrat from New York, pardon me. It's hard to tell sometimes, especially when we're looking at the state of New York. Gregory Meeks said, quote, to do those things, namely impeachment, to do those things, you have to have the votes. And when I see that we have Republicans who won't even have hearings in regard to oversight, so there's no oversight by Republicans, and they control the House, they control the Senate, they have the presidency. So realistically, I don't have the time. I'm worried about the country's economy, the American people, and that's where my efforts are going to be moving forward. Now, he said that in previous statements, right? So not looking forward to if the Democrats have the House and the Senate. But again, it's, oh, we don't have the votes. Once again, Democrats, instead of believing in something, like, you know, your oath to the Constitution and being the only check on a lawless president, we don't have a citizen's recall. We don't have snap elections. We don't have votes of no confidence. The only thing you can do for a lawless president is impeach him. But no, we can't do the right thing because it won't work. We can't do the right thing because it might hurt us politically. We can't do the right thing to defend the United States of America because we just don't have the votes. Well, then you have the vote anyway, and you put Republicans on the spot voting to keep the lawless president. You show to your base, you show to your voters that you did everything in your power to try to take down the lawless president. And it was his criminal conspirators in the Republican Party that kept him to term. Not the Democrats preemptively surrendering and allowing him to go to term. I don't know what to do about this aside from get angry and to exhort Democratic voters out there, independent voters out there, and even Republican never-Trumper types that want to see democracy thrive, to understand that there's the rot that has led us to this place is not a rot that just infected one side. It's not a rot that took over the Republican Party and then led to Donald Trump. It's also a rot that took over the Democratic Party and led to Bill Clinton and led to neoliberalism. And led to candidates being nominated who could possibly lose to Donald Trump twice. Yeah, I know misogyny. Yeah, I know racism. But if that's the world that you're fighting in, a world in which voters are misogynistic and racist, maybe throw the white guy out there because look like that worked in the middle there with Joe Biden. I'm sorry to say it. I'm not saying Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris weren't incredibly qualified candidates that I absolutely supported, but look what it got us. I know, and I just got through saying Democrats need to believe in something, and then I say shit like that. I know, it's tough. But we're in an existential crisis here in the United States of America as to whether or not this republic has any chance to continue another 25 years, let alone another 250. We need to look at the rot that has infected the Democratic Party as well. This rot that leads to the rise of people like Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries, empty suits who don't believe in anything but pleasing their donors. And if anything, I've gotten so much more sanguine on the idea of term limits. I was just thinking the other day about, you know, I can't remember which congressman or senator it was that was talking, but it was one of these guys on the way out. Maybe it was Tom Tillis. I don't know. I don't know which one. And, but one of these guys was on his way out and was saying something really bold about Trump or bold about the administration. I can't remember what it was. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, they sure do grow a spine when they don't have to run for re-election, don't they? They sure do grow some balls when they're retiring, don't they? Well, doesn't that argue for term limits then? Imagine if you could only serve 3 terms in the House or the Senate. Imagine every election, 1/3, every election cycle, 1/3 of the House and the Congress is on their way out, not having to worry about running for a re-election. Who knows? They might actually get something done. And one of the first things they should think about getting done is electing somebody else to be the leader in the House and someone else to be the leader in the Senate. It's time for the Democrats to move away from whoever it is can raise the most money and move to whoever it is can win the most hearts and minds, whoever it is that can win the most votes. There's a lot of good candidates out there, and as we get closer and closer to November, we'll probably be taking a look at more of them. But these statements from Hakeem Jeffries, he concluded by saying, quote, "That's been the American dream for decades, but for far too many people, that American dream has slipped out of reach, and we should be focused on actually doing the type of things necessary to ensure that people in this country cannot simply survive, but they can thrive. And that, of course, will be at the heart of all these midterm campaigns." Yes, affordability. Let's make it all affordable. No, what the people are clamoring for is justice and accountability. Because we know that if there's no accountability, these guys will just be back again. And they'll do the same things, and any little progress that we make on something will be erased. Like how we're seeing the Affordable Care Act be chipped away at. How we saw women's reproductive rights being taken away. How they're coming for gay rights. How they're completely on the precipice of once again crashing the economy on some bubble, this time AI. If they're not held accountable, if there's no pain for their crimes, there's no incentive structure for them to not change, and will be subject to this same cycle all over again. Get it through your thick skulls, Democrats and Democratic consultants. The American people want accountability. The American people want justice. And when those two things are accomplished, maybe you can finally get around to all the affordability and healthcare things that we've been doing half measures and workarounds and tax credits and means testing for. We can get around to actually building the Star Trek utopia that we all dream this country can be. And that's the end of this joint, my friends. The Radical Russ Show is produced, directed, researched, written, recited, posted, and catered by me, Radical Russ Belville, and governed by Creative Commons share-alike licensing. News, music, video clips, and social media posts are reproduced under fair use copyright laws for commentary and analysis. My main theme is We Love the Herb by Herbal Nation, and interstitial music is by Russ Boom Boom Belville.
What's the boom boom for?
Boom boom boom.
Which brings us to our post-credits scene.
Why do we do this?
Oh, God, not again.
Why do we keep doing this?
All right, so we're back on watching the TV from time to time. I've had to adjust my hashtag. It was TubiTVNight because I didn't have any streaming services. And then I got T-Mobile and got some streaming services. And then it was Netflix night. And then I'm like, oh, but I also watch Hulu. And I've also got the, what's the other one? Hulu, Netflix, and Paramount Plus, yeah, that we got for free. So, yeah, I want to have all those. So now it's just Russ TV night. You want to follow along on Blue Sky for my TV and movie recommendations, it's Russ TV Night. And my latest one was 2025's Nuremberg, which we watched last night with Rami Malek and Russell Crowe. And great movie. This was a good, good movie. Get 3.5, maybe 4 stars, but a couple quirks with it. First of all, I don't want to give too much stuff away. So if you haven't seen the movie, this is your spoiler alert to fast forward like a couple minutes in the podcast, or just, you know, it's the end. It's just the credits. You can skip this whole thing. Anyway, first thing, the interaction between Rami Malek as the psychiatrist and Russell Crowe as Hermann Goering. Right. That was the movie to me. That the two of those guys, ooh, that's some acting. That was some good stuff. 100% great. The other part where it's Michael Shannon as Justice Jackson leading the prosecution for the Allies at Nuremberg, like the courtroom drama side of it. I don't know. They kind of paint Justice Jackson. I think they didn't do him any favors. And it may be just because they had to simplify a very complex legal thing to make it palatable to a movie audience, but it just seemed way too simple, right? And it seemed like Justice Jackson was foiled by far too obvious a problem, like that he would have seen that document and read those words and realized none of them say kill all the Jews, right? So that just seems simplistic to me, but maybe it's because they had to simplify a much greater, more complex story. And then the payoff when the British prosecutor gets up there and then closes the case by basically saying, yeah, but y'all killed a bunch of Jews and you were the president, weren't you? That also seemed really simplistic, but okay, we'll take that. Other things about this movie. First of all, thank you for the 48-star flag. There's a very prominent scene where Malek is standing in front of a 48-star flag, and it just reminded me of how pissed off I was when I saw Oppenheimer. And there's that scene where Oppenheimer in 1948 is giving a big speech to a bunch of people, and they pan out to the people and they're all waving little 50-star flags in 1948. Come on, man, attention to detail. So thank you for that, director, whoever it was for Nuremberg. I should look that up. Also, great job on the dialogue and the costuming and everything, because, you know, whenever I'm watching one of these period pieces set in like the 40s or whatever, or earlier, and dialogue's going along and someone uses a phrase or a word in a way that would never have been used in that time period, it really throws me off. Like someone in a 40s piece says, awesome! Like, no, nobody in the 40s would have said awesome that way. Unless they were looking at the Grand Canyon and going, wow, what an awesome view. Anyway, so none of that in the movie. They did a good job there. One little thing on the subtitles. So I'm old, can't hear very well. So I watch movies with subtitles on, even though the audio was on as well. So I'm watching the movie, and every time it got to Hermann Goering or some of the Germans who were speaking German, the subtitle would just say, in brackets, speaking German. Except for a couple times. There was like one time when the translator said Auf Wiedersehen, and they printed Auf Wiedersehen. Well, why wouldn't you do that through the whole movie? Why would it just say speaking German? Why not actually put the German subtitle of what the people are saying? It's not like Netflix doesn't have German subtitles already. I think that would add to the flavor of the movie, especially for someone like me who has a rudimentary knowledge of German. I took like a semester in high school. So if I'd actually seen the German words he was saying, I might have been able to pick up on a little more nuance on what was going on in the movie instead of just speaking German. Yeah, it's a little thing. You can contact me by email at radicalrus@gmail.com. Call my message line at 877-RUS-420. That's 877-877-420. And reach me on social media on Blue Sky as radicalrus.com and nowhere else. You can support this podcast financially by donating to Radical Russ on Venmo, Rad Russ on Cash App, or via PayPal on my website at radicalrus.com. Get this podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, my website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and until next week, take care of each other. You try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seat, you plan it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it.